The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The storm clouds of Russian interference, if you will, started to form in my mind in the spring, early summer of 2016. We knew that the Russians would repeat what they've done in previous years as far as going forward with some propaganda and stuff. But when we started to get indications, which was a combination of intelligence as well as just piecing together some of the dots that were available publicly as well as available classified holdings, it became apparent to me that this was an effort that was basically unprecedented in scale, scope, and intensity.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 6th, 2020. Starting in January 2017, John Brennan became one of the president's most blunt critics among former national security professionals. In the years since, he has been working on writing a book, now out, called Undaunted, My Fight Against America's Enemies, at home and abroad. I sat down with John to talk about the book and his career. We talked about what brought him to the CIA, his career as a CIA officer and manager, his work overseas, at the CIA, and even in the White House as the deputy assistant to the president for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism for President Obama in his first term, and of course his time as CIA director in President Obama's second term. We covered some controversies, including enhanced interrogation and the reorganization of the CIA in the so-called modernization effort, as well as the Russian interference in the 2016 election, and of course, his outspoken criticisms of the president ever since. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 6th. John Brennan remains undaunted. To start, John, I need to put out a couple of caveats. First of all, an acknowledgement that I have worked with you before, going back to some time in the Middle East in the late 1990s. And secondly, that when the White House press secretary announced that your clearances were revoked, I was one of the signatories of the letters that came out decrying that move. So with that out of the way, really looking forward to talking with you, not as a disinterested interviewer, but somebody who lived through some of the events that we're going to talk about and saw what you were doing in many of these positions. But I have to say, I really didn't think you would be writing a book about your experiences. So why did you decide to do it?
Well, David, first of all, it's good to be with you. And thank you and all the other signatories to that letter decrying, as you said, the announcement by the White House that they want to take my security clearances. And I'm kind of curious as to why you think I wouldn't write a book.
Well, mostly because most CIA directors don't think they're going to, and then something pulls them into what's become now a more regular occurrence of writing a memoir and talking about one's experiences, even if you might not have imagined it years ago.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I start off my book by saying I never imagined I would write this memoir, which other directors have said also. And when I retired for the second time in January of 2017, I was not planning to do a memoir. I wanted to ride off into the retirement sunset and enjoy time with my family and catch up on reading and culture, all things that I missed during the 8 years of the Obama administration. But then over time, as I talked to my family and I talked to friends and colleagues, as well as former directors, they made the case that maybe it would be a good idea to put down on the record my recollections as a way to contribute to the historical record, mm-hmm. as well as to provide my sense of the events that I witnessed throughout the course of my career, and to try to set the record straight on some of the issues that I think have been mischaracterized and misrepresented in the public domain. So I think it was a combination of things that just convinced me that the balance then tipped to writing a memoir. And I read through, once again, a lot of the other memoirs that former directors read. I read them previously, but I said, okay, I'll sit down and try to write this. But also one of the things that has really motivated me over the last several years, I spent a lot of time speaking to university students. And I'm associated with my two alma maters, Fordham University in New York, as well as the University of Texas at Austin. In fact, I just lectured a class last week virtually at UT. I'll be doing one in Fordham in another week or so. I'm trying to encourage young Americans to seriously consider the future in public service, and specifically in the national security realm. And so when I was writing this book, I was trying to present what I felt was an exceptionally rewarding and challenging career that I had, and just to try to maybe entice some young Americans with tremendous potential and skills and intellect to consider a career maybe in the CIA or other intelligence agency or just in the government writ large.
Sure.
It's so important, I think, in this day and age to give back to this great country in the form of public service.
Now, you did not always want to be a CIA officer and eventually a CIA leader. Originally, as a young man, you were actually considering the priesthood, but somehow you ended up coming to CIA. Now, at the time that you joined, there was much less out there in the public domain about the experiences of an average CIA officer. So coming into the agency, what did you expect? And how was it the same or different from those expectations as you started?
Well, anybody who is outside the CIA will have their own impressions based on what they have read or what they have heard, or what just their basic impression is of the life of a CIA officer. And so I joined the agency in 1980. I was not yet 25 years old. I had traveled overseas a couple of times to Indonesia and to Egypt and spent some time over there and heard stories about what CIA spies were doing in different locations. But also I had spoken to a number of individuals, including former professors of mine at both Fordham and UT, who had some positive things to say about the people that they met at CIA, the depth of expertise that CIA officers had, as well as the importance of the intelligence mission. And so it intrigued me. There were some things that I was concerned about in terms of the stories I had heard about the CIA involved in some of this activities overseas. But again, I was encouraged by the people that I had met who knew about the CIA and were able to give me at least secondhand information about it. And then when I applied to the CIA and met some of the CIA officers who were interviewing me, I was really quite intrigued as well as very interested in pursuing the application, because I thought the CIA was going to give me the opportunity to learn more about the world,
right,
as well as to try to protect this country's security. And as I mentioned in the book, I'm the son of an immigrant, and my father impressed upon me and my siblings at an early age the importance of giving back to this great country of ours. And so CIA, for all of its reputation, both good, bad, and otherwise, I thought that it would allow me that opportunity to have a chance to explore the world, do something on behalf of my fellow citizens, and also learn a lot about life.
You ended up settling into the career track of an analyst in the office called NISA, the Near East and South Asian Analysis Office, which I also spent time as an analyst in. What did you like about being an analyst?
Well, I did start off in operations just very briefly. That's the director of operations of CIA hired me because of my foreign travel and my Arabic that I had at the time. But I felt that during that first year, when I had the opportunity to serve what's called interim assignments in both the director of operations and what was then the director of intelligence, or really the National Foreign Assessment Center, I thought that the work that the analyst did, which is to pour through all of the information and intelligence available to the CIA, that which is clandestinely collected, either from human sources or from technical collection systems, from diplomatic cables that come in from the State Department, from open source information, I felt that that was really intellectually challenging and interesting to be able to go through that those mounds and mounds of information, try to make sense of it. Frequently, there was conflicting information, and then to be able to be the one to either write about it for senior U.S. officials or to actually brief them. And so I just felt that that opportunity that was available to me then to be an analyst in CIA really was very much fitting with my interests, maybe my strengths, as well as my career aspirations.
Mm-hmm. And then you moved into management, first filling the shoes of certainly one of the nicest people I ever encountered in NISA and perhaps the entire agency, Jack Duggan, and then as a team chief in the Counterterrorist Center, and eventually briefly as a deputy division chief back in NISA. And you're pretty open about the fact that you did not think you were a good manager in some ways at first. You admitted to making some serious mistakes early on, and the fact that you eventually got more leadership training, which you sorely needed. What were some of those mistakes as a leader, and how did you learn from them?
Well, yeah, it was my first assignment as a manager, as the branch chief. And unlike the way things are now at CIA, where there is extensive training available to CIA officers, you know, from the first day they walk in the door, a lot of in-depth analytic training, as well as management and leadership training. And unfortunately, I didn't have those types of training opportunities back then. There was very little, quite frankly, emphasis on the leadership training. So one day I was an analyst in a branch, and the next day I was the branch chief. And so the mistakes I made included trying to, I think, mold the people that worked for me into people that reflected my strengths, my approaches to issues. I really needed to get a better sense of how everybody is different. And for good managers and leaders, you need to do certain things that's going to motivate your team, of course, but you also need to take into account what the needs are of individuals who you have responsibility for. And I think there were times that I was rather officious, that I massively rewrote and edited pieces so that they would reflect more my writing style and the way I would have written an analog piece. And I didn't take into account that there are many different variations of the analytic theme and that I needed to make sure that I was able to, I guess, encourage the individuals to carry out their responsibilities in a manner that made them feel that I was not going to just, again, overturn or rewrite what it is that they are doing. Mm-hmm. So there was just a lot of learning that I go through. There was, you know, I think adverse reaction in many respects to, you know, some of the things that I did. But as I recount in the book, I had the great benefit of having one of my colleagues, who basically hit me upside the head and said, "John, cut it out and learn to treat us, you know, in a manner that is more befitting of a leader and a good manager." And I'm forever grateful that Jim O'Brien did that to me.
Now, you also found your way to a position that few career analysts and analytic managers do. Not unheard of in agency history, but certainly rare for someone in the analytic track to become a chief of station overseas. But there you are in Saudi Arabia running operations in the country. How does running a station, especially as an analyst, differ from your other roles?
Well, although I was an analyst in the agency, I also had other opportunities to, I guess, expand my portfolio of, mm-hmm. of experiences and skills. When I served in Saudi Arabia in the late 1990s as the senior U.S. intelligence official to liaise with the Saudi government, I had already spent 2 years in the early 1980s in Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. as a political officer with the Department of State. I also had served as in the counterterrorism center and had a lot of counterterrorism experience, which was needed in Saudi Arabia in the late 90s since there were a series of attacks there. But also immediately before I went out to Saudi Arabia, after a time in NISA, I served as George Tenet's executive assistant when he was the deputy director of Central Intelligence. So I worked on the CIA's seventh floor and had broad exposure to all aspects of the CIA's mission and the different operational areas that the CIA was involved in. Before I did that for George Tenet, I also was President Clinton's daily briefer, the PDB briefer.
Right.
And so therefore, my exposure to the agency's mission and the different responsibilities the agency had was really quite broad, I guess, by the time I arrived in Saudi Arabia in the late 1990s. And I didn't just come from an analytic position. I came with a toolkit of those experiences that really helped me better understand how my role out in Saudi Arabia was part of a broader national security effort. And I think I had a very good understanding of how embassies operated, how the CIA as a whole has tremendous capabilities, mm-hmm. and what my principal responsibilities were out there. So, yeah, it's usual that most of those positions overseas are reserved for operations officers, but I wasn't the only individual who had an analytic background to serve in that type of position. Yep. But again, I think by that time of my career, I already had 16 years under my belt, with many of those years spent in non-analytic positions. That was the reason why I think I was tapped at that time.
And you mentioned working quite closely with George Tenet for some of those years. Talk a little bit about George and what you learned from him that helped you in your own leadership later on.
Well, George is the person most responsible, or some might say most to blame, for what I did in my career from the mid-1990s on. If it wasn't for the relationship with George, I know I never would have been President Obama's Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor to the White House for 4 years, nor CIA Director. George was one of the individuals that I would brief when I was the PDB briefer in the mid-1990s. He was the Director for Intelligence Programs in the National Security Council staff. And when he was nominated to be the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence when John Deutsch became director, George asked me to join him as he prepared for the nomination. And then once he was confirmed, he asked me to serve as his executive assistant. Mm-hmm. And since then, I served in a number of capacities directly working for George. I served as his chief of staff when I came back from Saudi Arabia in 1999. I served as his deputy executive director after that. George was the one who tapped me to be part of the stand-up of the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, which became the National Counterterrorism Center. So what I was most impressed about George, several things. One, tremendous work ethic. The man just worked himself around the clock, was always consumed with his responsibilities. And to me, that was something that I very much admired and tried to emulate. Secondly, he had a tremendous intellect, was able to absorb lots of information, and was somebody who was very much mission-focused and also was very much an admirer of the CIA's work long before he got to the CIA as deputy director, because he was the staff director of the Senate Intelligence Committee before he went to the National Security Council staff. But then George's integrity. He is somebody who put the integrity of the mission, his own personal integrity, above any type of political expediency. And he, I think, was a great role model for so many individuals at the agency for so many years. And so I learned a lot from George, and I have stayed close to him over the years. None of us are perfect individuals, and there were things that happened, I'm sure that George would have liked to have made, different decisions, but he carried out his responsibilities with tremendous competence, tremendous integrity, and tremendous selflessness in the interests of national security of this country. And so George was just a very special person, again, who mentored me, who took time to give me opportunities to grow as an officer. And I will be eternally grateful to him for that.
And he had to make some tough decisions, as all directors do, many of which never become public, everything from exfiltrations to counterintelligence issues. But some do become public. And in the last 20 years, boy, have we had some of them. Let me sound you out about some of these issues that you were in or around during the past 20 years in various roles. Let's do enhanced interrogations. You describe having been stunned and thrown off by a detailed description of one detainee's experience, and that while these techniques were deemed legal by all relevant authorities up to and including the Attorney General of the United States, you were quite uncomfortable. But you say that you didn't speak up much about it, and you have pulled your punches with George in particular, never saying that you thought the program was unethical. Why not?
Well, I recount in the book a discussion I had with George where I expressed my revulsion at the tactics, techniques, and that I felt as though it wasn't consistent with our values. I was not in the chain of command for that program at the time. I was the deputy executive director. So I was part of the senior leadership team. I knew about the program. I didn't know about a lot of the details because I wasn't in that, it's called a COVID Action Review Group, that actually reviewed and heard over this effort. But I guess it was when I read about some of these specific details of a waterboarding session that really just turned me against it. Now, this was in the aftermath of 9/11. The embers of the World Trade Center were still smoldering, and the CIA was on a mission to do everything possible to prevent a recurrence of 9/11. And the agency did some really heroic work. And I think that in the heat of a battle, sometimes maybe one's judgment is shaped by focus on the desired outcomes as opposed to maybe some of those tactics. And so I didn't speak out and speak up internally in CIA as much as I think maybe I should have. But as you point out, when there's a COVID action program like the detention interrogation program that is duly authorized by the President of the United States and the National Security Council, that is deemed legal by the highest legal advisory body in the Executive Department, the Office of Legal Counsel, Department of Justice, which is briefed to the oversight committees, CIA has, I think, a responsibility and obligation to try to carry out that mission to the best of its ability. And so I have always argued that for those CIA officers that operated within the four corners of what was authorized, they, should not be, held to account to a different standard maybe that's being applied today. But for officers who operated outside of those authorized boundaries, yes, they should have been held to account, and some were. But it was a very, very difficult time. And, I look back on it, and there's a lot of would have, could have, should haves. But I do think that the agency's record, although certainly blemished by this, is something that the CIA should be proud of, which was to prevent a recurrence of 9/11 attacks on the homeland.
Yep. One other initiative that was taken, much less controversially, but not without difficulty, was the creation of TTIC, you mentioned earlier, the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, which evolved into the National Counterterrorism Center. I think it was around March of 2003 when you were asked to take this organization under your wing. And you had a different challenge as a manager than you'd had before, because this was not the same as taking on an existing, highly functioning team, but of a true start from scratch organization, bringing together FBI and CIA systems with people in both organizations that did not want to share the best secrets with each other. How did you manage that creation of TTIC, and how did you get it on the path to where it has been ever since?
Well, in the aftermath of 9/11, when I was deputy executive director, I talked to George a number of times about the importance of trying to better integrate the capabilities as well as the data of the intelligence community in order to prevent another 9/11. Because I felt as though the FBI and CIA and NSA and this fledgling now new Department of Homeland Security that was called for in 2004, they needed to have a mechanism to share that information so that you could correlate the related information and intelligence. And so George then asked me to be CIA's rep to a task force that the White House had asked for to pull together a proposal about how better to ensure that we don't have another 9/11. And when this task force recommended that there be something like a terrorist threat integration center put together, George then said to me, okay, Brennan, this is your time to put up or shut up about this integration model and see if you can do it. So with some assistance of some very good people from around the community, we pulled something together. And I must say, I had to do a lot of battles, and especially with CIA. I had battles with FBI as well. I talk about in the book when I had some very, animated conversations and heated conversations with people like Bob Mueller, who was opposed to having FBI systems and networks go into this new organization. And I can understand how the agencies were protective of their information. They didn't want to expose it unnecessarily. But I must say, the battles I had that were most difficult were with my own home organization, CIA. CIA was very reluctant to push its networks into this new TTIC organization. They wanted to certainly do everything they could to protect their sources and methods, and so they were opposed to that integration of effort. But over time, and with the support of George and with Bob Mueller as well, we were able to build this organization as TTIC, and then it became NCTC, National Counterterrorism Center, first by executive order by President Bush in 2004, and then by legislation in the aftermath of the 9/11 Commission. So it was stood up as part of the reforms that were initiated after 9/11 by the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004 that called for the establishment of the Director of National Intelligence in an office to support him or her, and the stand-up of the National Counterterrorism Center. And so I had the honor of being the first director. I was the interim director because by legislation it was called for a Senate-confirmable director. And that was my last position before I retired in 2005. So it was a tremendous capstone, I felt, to the first part of my government career, to be a part of something that was really trying to have good government. By good government, being able to leverage optimally the data, the expertise, the systems, the networks, the authorities of various departments and agencies that were involved in the counterterrorism fight.
As you mentioned, you took a different tack then and spent some time in the private sector, but it wasn't long before you were doing something you had not done before, which is advising a political campaign. What drew you to the Barack Obama campaign and had you interested in playing that role?
Well, I was in the private sector, but I was still very interested in national security. And I was very impressed by this junior senator from Illinois who was quite, I think, clear about a vision for the United States. And I really felt that he had tremendous potential, even though he was junior and, didn't have all that much experience in the Senate, just a few years. I decided that maybe I can do something to lend my intelligence background to help him. And so I talked to George Tenet. George is very politically savvy and very well connected in Washington. I mean, he reached out to Tony Lake, the former national security advisor, who was one of the individuals I briefed when I was the PDB briefer at the White House. And Tony Lake was already working for Barack Obama. And so I had lunch with Tony, and we had lunch in D.C. when he asked me if I would be willing to help Barack Obama by providing some intelligence support to his team. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So this was in early 2008. And so I wrote some memos and was on some conference calls and wrote some emails. And, you know, I never met President Obama before he was elected, but I was very happy to provide any type of input I was asked for that might help them develop a national security platform that I thought would help our national security interests.
You were considered at that point for the director position at CIA, but ultimately took a position that in some ways you said was more directly related to the president working in the White House on counterterrorism and homeland security issues. Talk a little bit about that role, especially how it differed from playing the role of intelligence advisor to now being a de facto policy advisor.
Yeah, it was really quite different for me, different in two respects. As you point out, I was now going to be on the policy side of that intelligence policy relationship. And as tough as intelligence is, that profession, it really is tough to be a policymaker. Because when you're on the intelligence side, you just, you know, sort of tee up the intelligence platter to the policymakers and basically say, okay, now you try to make sense of all of this or do what you can to protect our interests. When you're on the policy side, you're the recipient of that intelligence and a tremendous feed of intelligence, yes, but you know, often the policy options are, you know, bad, very bad, and cataclysmic. And you try to find the best option available as a policymaker. So it took a while for me not to play my intelligence role, although I must say that I think one of the reasons why I was invited to the White House was because I had that intelligence background. And I think Barack Obama was looking for somebody who could help to interpret and translate some of the things that were coming in from the intelligence community. But the other big change for me was having that Homeland Security portfolio, because I knew counterterrorism, you know, quite well based on my experience. And I thought Homeland Security at the time was the manifestation of terrorism on the homeland. But it involves so many other things, from hurricanes and floods, earthquakes, pandemics, Gulf oil spills, cyber, you name it. And so there was a steep learning curve for me on a number of these issues. And that first year or so, we had a lot of the challenges on the home front, including the H1N1 pandemic in April of 2009.
Right, right.
So I enjoyed that portfolio. I felt it was enriching in terms of a learning experience, but it was different.
You certainly were prepared for the terrorism part of the portfolio, but some things you probably had a harder time with, even just as a human being. And I'm thinking here of what you've described as your most emotional experience during your time at the White House. Describe the morning of December 14th, 2012, and how the day developed.
Well, every morning in the White House, we would gather early for the intelligence session, the PDB, when the president would receive the briefing, the director of national intelligence or another senior officer, and we would sit around and talk about that. And before I went up for that session, I had a report that there was an incident in Connecticut at an elementary school that was involving a gunman. And I was told at the time that it appeared as though the situation had been contained, that the individual was cornered in one part of the school, and that a tragedy seemed to be averted. And so, as I recall, this was something that was delivered to the Oval Office by my assistant, Nick Shapiro. And so the president was very concerned about what he had heard, but again, relieved that it appeared to be something that was not going to be a tragedy. When I went back down to my office after the PDB session concluded, I had a call from Sean Joyce, the deputy director of FBI, who told me that it appears as though there were 24 killed in a shooting by that gunman, and that most of them were little children. And Sean's voice cracked when he told me, and I just sat in stunned silence as I listened to him. And when I hung up the phone, I knew I had to go up and tell the president about it. And when I went up to the Oval Office, the door was open, and I told the special assistant that I needed to see him, and he was reading something that had a smile on his face and a letter or something. And when I walked in, I think he noticed the look on my face and said, "What's up?" And I explained to him what had happened. And it was, you know, a tremendous shock for him to hear that. And as I say in the book, I think we both were reacting as parents at the time, and just the trying to envision the carnage and the sorrow and agony of the parents whose lives were torn asunder by the death or, you know, devastating injuries of their children. It was a very emotional moment. And it's that type of incident that really brings home these events in our country, that we rely on a president of the United States to guide us, to lead us, and to be that leader that we're all, you know, proud of. At the same time, the president of the United States is a person. And Barack Obama, I think at the time, just showed that his emotional reaction to the news of the horrific killing of those children showed his humanity and his care for every citizen of this country. And so it was something that, you know, is vivid in my memory, just because of just how shocking and horrific that tragedy was.
And frankly, one of many tough issues that the president dealt with in those times that you were involved in. Another one was the issue of targeted strikes against terrorists coming after Americans. Obviously, we've talked about the enhanced interrogation techniques, but if capturing and detaining and interrogating a terrorist suspect is either not feasible or unpalatable, we had the ability to use targeted strikes. Talk about the ethics of that. You were there with one president making these decisions. What goes into a president's ethical calculus for making a decision to end someone's life?
Well, I think that the primary responsibility of a president of the United States is to protect the lives and welfare of American citizens. And unfortunately, too often, terrorists have posed a serious threat to American lives, both here at home as well as abroad. And when President Obama became president in January of 2009, he recognized that Al-Qaeda was still quite formidable and had a number of plots underway to carry out attacks against our people, our interests, our facilities. And I had the responsibility to be, as his advisor, to recommend when I thought that certain actions needed to be taken. And the calculus that we used in the Obama White House was that we wanted to make sure that any time we felt that some type of lethal action, offensive action needed to be taken, there was no other recourse to preventing a terrorist attack from taking place. We would try to work very closely with the intelligence security services around the globe. We tried to see whether or not there was an opportunity for capture or arrest. But frequently, because of where these terrorists reside and where they burrow, that was not possible. And so as we would see these threats mature and get closer to being carried out, we had a decision to make, whether or not we decided that it was important to take a terrorist life in order to save an innocent life. And in doing so, we did everything possible to minimize the loss of innocent life. By that, I mean, when we took strikes, there was a requirement of near certainty that no, what we call non-combatants, no man, woman, or child who was not a terrorist would not be killed. And I think that during the Obama administration, there was very, very effective and surgical use of these capabilities. You know, many of them carried out by drones. These are the unmanned aerial platforms that launch missiles from great distances against targets. And the precision of those strikes, as well as the strength of the intelligence and the assessment of near certainty that is somebody who poses a lethal threat to American interests, and that the attack will be carried out without killing or injuring any civilians. These were the standards that we tried to apply. And in the book, I tried to go through in some detail what a conversation with President Obama was like, when I would have to bring up to him this recommendation, what we would do to try to minimize any unintended effects, but also to live up to our responsibilities to protect American lives. And unfortunately, I think there was a lot of misrepresentation in the media, particularly in the foreign media, but also in the American media, about the number of civilian casualties. I will say and admit and say in the book that there were innocent lives that tragically were taken when these strikes were carried out, but they were far, far less than what was purported to be the case by a number of media outlets. So it was a heavy responsibility. I wish I never had to have been in that position. But when I agreed that I would, in fact, fill that position for the president, I knew that I would have to go forward and be part of that effort.
Talk a bit about one of the toughest calls that certainly came up in this regard, and that's Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen, the one actively plotting against Americans. Talk about the tensions that came up regarding a U.S. citizen in the crosshairs in one of these actions.
Yes. Well, Mr. al-Awlaki was a very well-known and senior al-Qaeda member of the al-Qaeda in Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, which was based in Yemen. And he had been involved for a number of years with them and was actively involved in plots to carry out lethal terrorist attacks against the United States, including against airliners. And we work with the Yemenis to try to mitigate that threat. We're not able to, partly because the Yemenis were both unable and unwilling in some instances to do what they needed to do. And so it was decided that we would tee up to the president a decision to carry out a lethal strike against Mr. al-Awlaki because he was involved in very active plotting and giving direction to operatives to carry out these attacks. The fact that he was a U.S. citizen obviously posed a series of challenges and questions, mm-hmm. because as a constitutional lawyer, President Obama in particular, but also the rest of us around the table, were cognizant of the obligations to not trample upon the due process rights of U.S. citizens. And so we had numerous meetings in the White House involving the Department of Justice and others, and looked at whether or not this strike could be ordered. U.S. citizens have been killed in the past on foreign battlefields as part of a foreign military force. But this would be the intentional and specific targeting of an individual who happened to be an American citizen. And then after a series of discussions and exchanges, including whether or not there should be some type of outside body that might look at this issue and make recommendations about whether or not a lethal strike should be taken, it was decided that this fell within the legal authority of the executive branch and the President of the United States, that Anwar al-Awlaki had taken up arms against the United States as part of al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. and that the United States would be fully within its authorities to carry out a strike. And the president decided that in the absence of other options to mitigate that threat, that strike would take place. But it was not something that was done quickly. The discussions went on for quite a while, but ultimately the Office of Legal Counsel prepared a memo basically saying that, yes, the president has this authority and that Mr. Al-Awlaki's rights would not be abridged as a result of this strike.
Let me ask you about just one more thing, John, from your time at the White House, which is in May of 2011, the Abbottabad raid that resulted in the death of Osama bin Laden. How confident were you personally in the intelligence that you had seen that the pacer, the tall man seen in that compound, was in fact bin Laden?
Well, you know, there were two things that gave me confidence. One was I was following the intelligence very closely, and the CIA was sharing that intelligence with me in the White House. And looking at it, and given my background experience, I just felt as though it very much pointed in the direction, not conclusively, but certainly strongly suggested that this pacer in the Abbottabad compound was Osama bin Laden. I guess what really tipped the scales for me was the views of the CIA officers, analysts, operations officers, reports officers, others, who were tracking bin Laden for so many years. And it was basically their mission to find him and track him down. And there were several CIA officers and briefers at the White House who I knew personally from my previous tenure at CIA and who I greatly respected, who spoke with confidence, saying that they believed it was the case. And I put a lot of stock in their views because I knew that they were world-class analysts and they were the people who had this in their blood in terms of finding bin Laden. So the combination of my own review of the intelligence as well as the confidence that I heard from the CIA experts convinced me that, again, it wasn't a certainty, but I weighed in with the president saying that I believe that it was him and that it was important to go forward with that raid. And ultimately, I think that was clearly the right call.
From that job, of course, you ended up back at CIA as director. Let's talk about a few topics here. First, why did you take the oath on a copy of the Constitution?
Well, I wanted to send a signal that I am a firm believer in the rule of law. And to me, putting a hand on the Bible, you know, although I was raised, you know, in a very strong religious Catholic household, I guess I have, you know, I'm an avowed agnostic now, and also just a firm believer in this country's foundations and the Constitution. And so I was trying to send a signal that I was putting my hand and swearing an oath of allegiance on the document that really governs our government and its actions. And so I inquired about whether or not I could get a special copy of the Constitution, and my staff inquired of the National Archives and was able to get an original copy of a draft of the Constitution that had George Washington's actual personal edits on that was kept under lock and key at the National Archives. I said, wow, that would be terrific. Able to put my hand on that document. So sure enough, the National Archives brought it over that morning and brought it into the room where I, result room where I took the oath of office. And again, I think I was just trying to signal that John Brennan and CIA were committed to the rule of law and the constitutional foundations of this country. Now, my critics pointed out that draft of the Constitution did not have the Bill of Rights, and as conspiracy theorists tend to do, they pointed out that this was my effort to not say that I'm going to honor those First Ten Amendments, but it was my way to signal my tremendous faith and belief and embrace of the rule of law.
And historically, honestly, it's pretty hard to get George Washington's contemporaneous edits on the Constitution with the Bill of Rights, which weren't there at the time. So seems like a silly complaint to me. Usually things like reorganizations aren't exciting stuff, but you did initiate the largest reorganization effort in modern CIA history. Let's talk about what became known as the modernization effort. You'd served in the Counterterrorist Center, an integrated center, unlike much of the agency at the time. You'd stood up TTIC, which eventually became NCTC. How did these inform your views of the need for different stovepipes at the agency to start working together on various regional and functional issues?
Well, they absolutely did. So back in the 1980s, when the Goldwater-Nichols Act was passed and that the U.S. military then was reformed to bring together the services under unitary chains of command around the globe. So you have Central Command and European Command and so on, where the Navy, Army, Air Force, Marines come together. That was a powerful model for me that I always admired. And so then when I had the opportunity to go into CTC and I could see that, you know, CIA, FBI, Secret Service, and other departments and agencies were collaborating there, and that the different parts of the agency were collaborating there, I just felt that that was a really good example of optimizing capabilities, expertise, experiences, responsibilities. And then the stand-up of the TTIC and the NCTC gave me the opportunity to actually shape that and try to make it a reality, which it very much became. And the NCTC is a great and strong organization today. So when I returned to the agency as director in March of 2013, I felt as though I had a lot of experience in CIA and as well as in the national security realm and the government. And I believe very much in a matrix model organization and integration. Although I'm a liberal arts, I have a liberal arts background, I'm very much a proponent of systems engineering, trying to figure out how you're going to bring together all of the components and processes and practices and capabilities and authorities, again, to optimize the outcomes that you want. So when I got back to CIA, I said to myself, I'm not just going to be a caretaker director. I'm going to try to position the agency to deal with the challenges of the 21st century. Because the challenges, national security challenges of this century are far different than the ones of last century. And our capabilities are far different. And technology has just revolutionized all different types of activities and businesses. And CIA is no different. So that's when I launched the modernization initiative, which was to take a look at how the CIA was structured. And I told the group that I had tasked to come up with ideas that I was a great admirer of Goldwater-Nichols and of the integrated model. Mm-hmm. And I challenged them to come back to me. And if they felt that the agency structure, which was basically the same over the last 60, 70 years, was not in need of any change, I think they would have a hard time convincing me of that. And so we decided then to create mission centers, very much like U.S. military combatant commands, where you bring together the operations officers and analysts and scientists and technologists and cyber specialists and support types so that you are able to be much more effective in leveraging all those capabilities against your area of responsibility, whether it be a regional area such as the Middle East or whether it be a functional area such as terrorism or counterintelligence.
Another major issue that developed during your tenure as director was, of course, the Senate Intelligence Committee Majority's report on rendition, detention, and interrogation, or RDI. Just quickly, what did that report do right, and what did it get wrong, and why?
Well, there's a lot in that report that I think accurately and factually recounts some of the details of that detention interrogation program, which was a wide-ranging, extensive program. And so I think that the report does have a lot of information about the nature, extent of that. I felt that the report fell short for a couple of reasons. One is that the CIA really did heroic work after 9/11. I don't think there was any agency more responsible for preventing a recurrence of the 9/11 attacks than was CIA, because it had this worldwide mission that it moved against very aggressively. Yes, it made some mistakes, and some of them were very, you know, egregious mistakes. And so the CIA needed to learn from that and also to be held account. But the CIA was never really prepared to carry out a program like this. It never had done it in its past, and it was ill-equipped and ill-prepared to do it. But unfortunately, as many things that happen on the Hill, increasingly so in the national security and intelligence realm, which was unlike years ago, there was a partisan agenda, I think, that was at play, at least for part of this report. Initially, it was a bipartisan report in the SSCI, but then the Republicans backed out in 2009, and it became a Democratic-authored report. And unfortunately, I think there were Democratic staffers and some of the members who really were not just trying to have an account of what transpired in that program, but also to try to put it in a very damaging light so that political points could be scored. And I really believe that at least the versions that we saw first before we corrected some of the mistakes was a very, very one-sided and partisan view. And I think that the committee, unfortunately, lost the opportunity to carry out what was needed, which would have been a strongly bipartisan, objective, and fair accounting of what the CIA did right and did wrong. But again, unfortunately, as I detail in the book, I think that there were some partisan political objectives at play here.
A real missed opportunity there. Walk us through the summer of 2016, when you started to realize that the Russian operation concerning the forthcoming presidential election was far more than its usual hacking into computers simply to collect information about the candidate and potentially influence them in the future, but that it was so much more. What struck you at the time? What was going through your mind when that revelation was there that this is in fact a truly historic event?
Well, the storm clouds of Russian interference, if you will, started to form in my mind in the spring, early summer of 2016. We knew that the Russians would repeat what they've done in previous years as far as going forward with some, propaganda and stuff. But when we started to get indications, which was a combination of intelligence as well as just piecing together some of the dots that were available publicly as well as available, in classified holdings, it became apparent to me that this was an effort that was basically unprecedented in scale, scope, and intensity, and that it had the personal blessing of Vladimir Putin, who was determined to try to undermine the integrity of our election and try to hurt Hillary Clinton, who I think the Russians did believe in the summer of 16 was going to be the president of the United States, and tried to bloody her before she became president as a way to have a weakened individual assume, the presidency, but also to enhance the electoral prospects of Donald Trump. And so when I started to see more and more of those indications, and I felt as though the barometric readings now were becoming much more ominous, I tried to delve deeply into all of the intelligence and met with the analysts and felt as though I needed to ring the bell. And that's why in the book I recount the meeting I had with President Obama in late July, where I told him what we had learned and what we had assessed, and that we didn't know what else the Russians might do before the election day. And that's when, it led to a series of efforts to try to make sure that we could collect as much as we could about what the Russians were doing, to inform the Gang of Eight in Congress, to also make sure that we had a good sense of what the Russians were doing and what we might be able to do to try to deter them from undermining the election.
John, you've talked about various presidents that you've briefed, but we haven't touched on much of them here. But quickly, pointing out that you did brief George H.W. Bush and were quite impressed with his command of intelligence and his serious approach. You, of course, were the regular briefer for Bill Clinton for, I think, more than a year. and got to know him and his team well. You also had experiences with George W. Bush and say that there are a lot of common misunderstandings about him, that he, in fact, took intelligence very seriously. And of course, he worked very closely with President Obama. But none of that seems to have prepared you well for January 6th of 2017, when you met Donald Trump in person for the first time. Talk about how that meeting in particular and the experiences afterwards showed you that Donald Trump was a unique president.
Yeah, well, as you point out, I briefed and got to know four presidents: George H.W. Bush, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. And what they shared was a tremendous seriousness with which they treated intelligence and the respect that they had for the intelligence profession, intelligence professionals, as well as those individuals around the globe who work on behalf of CIA and others. They also had an insatiable thirst for information, and they all absorbed information in different ways. They had different, right, you know, preferences, whatever. But I never doubted for a moment that any time I would be in the Oval Office or in the White House Situation Room talking to or briefing a president, that they didn't want to hear the intelligence. They might have disagreed with it. They might have found it unwelcome because it was contrary to maybe what a policy preference was. But they always wanted to hear it because it was such an integral part of what they needed for their calculus to make policy decisions. Now, when I met Donald Trump, the first and only time, which was in Trump Tower in January 6th of 2017, when I accompanied Jim Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, and Jim Comey, FBI, and Mike Rogers of NSA, we briefed him on the intelligence community assessment on Russian interference in the election. I already had a good sense of who Donald Trump was and is, because, you know, he was clearly a celebrity who, since I'm from the New York City area, I knew about his many exploits. But I also knew what he was like during the campaign and even after his election. And I was expecting that he was not going to be a typical type of, you know, presidential recipient of intelligence. But I still was rather appalled and disconcerted by how he dealt with intelligence information. I think he was always looking at it from the standpoint of how does this affect him? How does it affect his political and personal agendas? And he wasn't looking and receiving intelligence from the standpoint of how he's going to use that to promote the United States' national security interests. I think he looks at it from the standpoint of how is he going to either use it for his own purposes or denigrate and disregard it because it's not helpful. And that session in Trump Tower further reinforced my perspective of his lack of interest, quite frankly, in intelligence.
And since that time, you have not been shy about calling out President Trump for the things he is doing that violate our norms of national security and presidential behavior. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that perhaps the biggest controversy surrounding you as CIA director has come when you have no longer been Director Brennan, but you have been Private Citizen John Brennan, having a platform because of your previous career, but calling out the president after he appeared at the memorial wall at CIA headquarters, saying he should be ashamed of himself because you were saddened and angered by his display there, using words in future tweets and appearances like disgraceful, unprincipled, and unethical. And then after Helsinki, of course, saying it was nothing short of treasonous. Other former agency leaders and others in the intelligence community have chosen to take a less direct path. And I just want to hear your thoughts on whether you understand their concerns about the path you're taking, but why you feel like it is the right thing to do, all things considered.
Well, a couple of things. One is that I'm not alone in speaking out among former directors. Mike Hayden, I think, has been very forceful, and it's a very welcome and important voice out there. Mm-hmm. Jim Clapper, others, Leon Panetta. So I think there's been a fair number of individuals who have spoken out against what truly is an aberration right now in terms of who we have in the Oval Office. I was interested in my second retirement of riding off quietly into the sunset, but I find that Donald Trump's unprincipled, unethical, and disgraceful behavior obliges me to speak out. You know, if we had we have policy differences, I don't agree with a lot of the policies, that he has, implemented, but that's not what bothers me the most. What bothers me the most is how he has really abused the office of the presidency, the disgraceful displays of petulance, vindictiveness, how he continually lies to the American public. He is exceptionally dishonest and, I believe, corrupt. And I served this country and this government for over 33 years. I believe very strongly in the importance of integrity in government and honesty in government. And I'm not a member of either political party. I am a nonpartisan. When I was in the Obama administration, when I was director of CIA, it was Democratic senators who were calling for my head and asking me to be, fired or to resign. And now it's, people think that I am a Democratic mouthpiece. I'm not. I will speak out against anybody from any party that I believe abuses their responsibilities and obligations. And I can think of no better example of that abuse, malfeasance, and corruption than Donald Trump. And I, quite frankly, am aghast that so many individuals continue to follow him in cult-like fashion, despite his continuous display of outrageous and, I think, unethical and unprincipled behavior. But aside from that, I don't feel strongly about the issue.
just that. Finally, John, you've said many times that you've now retired twice from government. However, if there were to be a new president and that president were to call you and seek out your advice, counsel, and possibly senior job in the government, is this something you would consider? Because when the president asks, assuming the president is fit for office, the tendency is to say yes. What do you think?
I would be willing to give my advice and counsel whenever asked. And to the extent that my background or experience can help somebody keep this country safe and strong, I will certainly do that and salute. But my government and national security career is behind me. I was so privileged and honored to serve in the positions I did. And what I'm doing right now, while writing this book, is that I'm affiliated with my alma maters, Fordham University in New York, as well as University of Texas in Austin. And I talk to students, I lecture, I give them career advice and guidance. I really am trying to encourage young Americans from all backgrounds and disciplines and areas of interest to think about public service as a career option, to think about national security, think about CIA. Because even though a lot of young Americans and others are down right now on the government because of what we have witnessed over the last 3.5 years, mm-hmm. I tell them that this is exactly the time that they need to raise their hand and come to the government, because the world in the 21st century has just so many challenges ahead of us that we really need to tap into that tremendous reservoir of talent, skill, intellect, expertise that resides in our country. This country is the melting pot of the world, and bad on us if we don't optimize the opportunities that provides us. So over the rest of my life, I'm just going to try to do what I can to speak out when I feel it's important for me to do so, but also to spend as much time as I can encouraging other Americans to really think about the importance of public service and giving back to this great country what we all have derived from it.
What a great place to leave it. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please rate the podcast, spread word about the podcast, and visit the Lawfare store. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. Zachary Frank was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.